Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. A school cooperative in coal country is changing how people think about education and their region's future.
People would be surprised by this from what their stereotype for people around here is. Literally, we're proving their stereotype wrong.
We'll meet high school students in eastern Kentucky who are learning real-life skills by building tiny homes.
So most of the time whenever you're in other classrooms, if you have an idea, you're not allowed to do it. You have to stick with what the teacher tells you to do. But in here, you're allowed to do anything that comes to your mind.
We do the best we can, and when we get finished, buddy, it will look like $1 million.
And wildlife experts agree, the eastern mountain lion is extinct. So why do so many people across Appalachia swear they've seen mountain lions?
The idea that there could be this animal out there that might be following you and you'd never know it, you'd never see it, you'd never suspect it was there, you know, that just gets people.
You'll find these stories and more this week Inside Appalachia. Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. As coal country looks for a new path forward, some communities are looking to their public schools. Some school administrators are changing not just how they prepare students, but how they can help meet economic and social challenges. In a new series, Changing Course, reporters at the Ohio Valley Resource track the work of a Kentucky school cooperative. As Jeff Young reports, the schools there have an ambitious goal to help communities reinvent themselves.
Betsy Lane High School is in Stanville, Kentucky, population 206. Students there produce a program called the Bobcat Banter. Usually they talk sports or student life, but early last year, Bobcat Banter had some special guests.
Have you ever wondered what kind of cereal Bill Gates prefers?
Have you ever wondered if Melinda Gates can dance the whip in the nay-nay?
We'll find out the answers to those
questions. That's right. The world's richest man, Bill Gates, and his partner in life and philanthropy, Melinda, dropped in for a chat.
A few questions. So why or how did you come to Betsy Lane High School?
Now, you might expect the Gateses had come to see coal country problems or failings of small-town schools. Nope. They were there to see how other schools could achieve what Betsy Lane has.
If I could lift Betsy Lane up and make every high school around the nation do what's going on inside this building, we would get there.
The Gateses and later Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg visited Eastern Kentucky to see the schools participating in the Kentucky Valley Educational Cooperative. The 22 school districts in the cooperative serve some of the most rural, rugged country in Appalachia. Towns and counties struggling with some of the country's most profound economic and public health problems. But by working together, these schools have found ways to innovate in classrooms.
We were getting to work with programs, we're getting to work with technology.
I'm in ninth grade and we're building a 3D drone.
Other groups are working with robots.
We're printing like all the different parts to a drone and we're going to get it to fly.
We have 3D printing going on, we have everything in this class and it's just really awesome.
Schools in the cooperative emphasize personalized learning, team projects, and an entrepreneurial attitude. They also work to connect people with healthcare and maybe help the region find a new path forward.
We are really ambitious.
That's the cooperative's executive director, Jeff Hawkins.
What we believe is that our K-12 communities can serve as catalytic drivers to reinvent the communities where we live.
How can schools help communities reinvent themselves? Resource reporters Mary Meehan and Benny Becker spent months visiting with students, teachers, and administrators to learn more. First, here's Benny.
Desi Bowling is the associate director for the cooperative, but before she took that role, she was a teacher for 28 years. There's one excuse, she says, she heard a lot when she was teaching.
I would have kids say that they didn't need to get an education because they could go into the coal mines and make more money than what I was making.
It's a line of reasoning I've also heard a lot in my reporting. Take Mackie Branham Jr. He worked underground for 19 years before he was forced to stop working because he'd contracted the most severe form of black lung disease.
I come straight out of school, turned down full scholarship to go to college because I knowed I'd go straight in and make good money because I wanted to start my own family.
Bowling says the region's loss of coal jobs has had a big impact on the community's sense of what's possible.
People may have lost hope because they thought that there was nothing else that they could do, but I think our funding from the Race to the Top grant has enabled us to really showcase that there are opportunities out there.
In 2013, the Kentucky Valley Educational Cooperative was awarded a $30 million federal grant to go toward personalized education and career readiness work. A large part of the funding has been re-granted to teachers and students in the cooperative schools. Students across eastern Kentucky have been inventing new products, building and racing drones, coding software, and a whole lot more. I spoke to ninth graders in a hands-on technology class at Belfry High School in Pike County, and they told me they felt empowered to define their own future.
People would be surprised by this from what their stereotype for people around here is. Literally, we're proving their stereotype wrong.
I'm Mary Meehan in Hazard, Kentucky, where Sandy Hogg leads the cooperative's health programs. Kids can't learn if they can't concentrate or are sick, and Eastern Kentucky leads the nation in rates of diabetes and childhood obesity. Hogg says the cooperative uses school-based clinics to treat the whole child.
We had mental health and, you know, physical health, and we do physical exercise. We have programs all throughout our district. The kids are exercising so many minutes a day.
Local health providers worked with school districts, starting with the clinic in Letcher County. The cooperative now serves 40,000 students and about 2,000 staff. Eight districts also have telehealth clinics. But Hogg says connecting kids with care can be a challenge.
Well, the biggest challenge I think that we have is the terrain that we live in. So therefore, we saw the problem that our children weren't able to get to the doctors like they should.
Hogg calls the terrain treacherous, but many also lacked reliable cars. A night clinic had to be halted because of safety concerns. A family of five, two adults and three children, drove to the clinic on a single four-wheeler. Plus, for struggling families, the cost of a single tank of gas can sometimes be out of reach.
And they just can't. They don't have that money.
But Hogg says the opioid epidemic carries over into the classroom.
In some of our districts, 50%, and this is astounding, of our children are being raised by their grandparents or someone other than their parents. We have a terrible problem with opioid use, and we need to find a solution.
Over the coming months, Mary and Benny will report for us on how the school cooperative can help Appalachia's coal country change course. Chuck Fluarty directs the Rural Policy Research Institute at the University of Iowa. He's worked with communities dealing with big economic change. Fluarty says Eastern Kentucky's situation is among the toughest.
This is occurring in one of the most challenged regions in our nation.
It's not just the high unemployment from the loss of coal jobs. Consider a few other statistics. The region has some of the country's highest overdose death rates. And in some of the counties the school systems serve, life expectancy is years shorter than the national average. But Fluarty, who has worked with the Kentucky Valley Cooperative, is optimistic.
It's actually a revolution in how the schools in that region view their role, and it's about building total human and social capital, recognizing the school is at the center because the kids all come there every day.
For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Jeff Young in Louisville.
In eastern Kentucky's coal country, jobs are scarce and many people struggle with substandard housing. Some high school students think they can help tackle those big problems by building tiny homes. As part of the series Changing Course, Benny Becker reports on a project called Building It Forward that is vocational students designing, building, and selling tiny homes.
So come in, we'll go in.
In the back of a parking lot in Hazard, Kentucky, Desi Bowling shows visitors around a tiny house built by students from nearby Knott County.
If you look up in the loft, it has a queen-size bed.
This tiny house is built on an 18-foot-long trailer bed. It has a beautiful oak interior, and there's no space wasted. There are even drawers built into the stairs. Bowling is the associate director of the Kentucky Valley Educational Cooperative. This past school year, the cooperative funded three Eastern Kentucky vocational schools to design and build tiny homes. The project gives students practical skills working as a team, and Bowling explains each of the schools can afford to build a second tiny house this year because all three structures sold at a profit.
Each year these will be sold to be able to continue this project next year, and kids, as they come through, everybody will have this opportunity.
3 years ago, the cooperative won a $30 million federal grant to fund innovation and personalized education in classrooms throughout eastern Kentucky. Bowling says the Tiny House Project is an effort to make sure that all of the cooperative schools offer classes that are interesting and valuable to students, even if they're not planning on going to college.
One group that may not have benefited right from the beginning was the vocational school students.
That rumble in the background is the sound of another student-built tiny home getting hauled away. Charles Hawkins explained that one of his sons bought it to use as temporary housing.
They discovered that they had a black mold in the house, so they're going to get this to use until that's finished, and then they'll either sell this thing or take it out to the lake somewhere and park it.
Hawkins says they got interested in tiny houses from watching reality TV shows like Tiny House Nation.
Trust me, tiny homes are the next big thing.
Hawkins says he thinks it's important that schools focus on practical projects like building tiny homes.
They need to concentrate more on vocational trade, because every kid that goes to school is not destined to become a lawyer or a doctor. Somebody has got to fix the plumbing. Somebody's got to wire the house.
Every student I've spoken to has said they really enjoy learning these kinds of practical skills. For instance, Charles Colin Mosley, who worked on the drawers and stairs you heard about earlier.
So I took a lot of pride in those steps. These are custom. They're real sturdy. I'm just really proud of it.
Steve Richardson is a truant officer in Knott County. He says the Tiny House Project has made a big difference for some of the students who in previous years had missed a lot of class to the point where he'd had to make home visits.
We've been able to get them involved in the learning process, whereas before we were struggling to do that.
Danny Vance is the principal of Knott County's vocational school. He was also struck by how much time and care students put into building the tiny house.
I was a teacher for 21 years before becoming an administrator, and I don't remember many of my students coming down on Saturday and Sunday to work on a project like they did on this one. It's just the best project I've ever been involved with.
Vance says he thinks students are more invested in the project because it has real-world results.
This has to be done right, and if it's not right, somebody's going to pay the price down the road.
Three schools are building their second tiny house this year, and five other schools got funding from the cooperative to join the ranks and build their own tiny homes. The vocational school in Letcher County, Kentucky, is one of the sites building a tiny house for the first time.
Could you explain what's going on here?
Yes, we had to cut a piece of OSB, and now they're just knocking it in with a piece of wood and drilling holes on the side of it. Then they're just going to screw it down, and then that's four laid.
That's Haley Hart, a student in the carpentry class. She says she likes how much freedom she has in this class to come up with ideas and see them through.
Because most of the time whenever you're in other classrooms, if you have an idea, you're not allowed to do it. You have to stick with what the teacher tells you to do. But in here, you're allowed to do anything that comes to your mind.
Hart says the class has made her more confident.
I wouldn't ever imagine I could be like in the process of helping building a tiny house.
One of her classmates, Matthew Collier, says he thinks the Tiny House Project has given all the students not just confidence, but also a new sense of hope.
Every kid that we have in our classroom is real confident, and everybody has fun in this class. I mean, everybody loves this class. We do the best we can, and when we get finished, buddy, it will look like $1 million.
Scott McReynolds heads the Housing Development Alliance, based in Hazard, Kentucky. He points out that construction and home repair are kinds of work that can't be outsourced.
You can't call somebody in India and say, my roof leaks. You got to have somebody there to patch your roof. And the sort of skills the students are learning, not just how to hammer and how to saw, but the deadlines, budgets, that all translates into what they need to be successful in those sorts of careers.
McReynolds says there are a lot of housing needs in the hills of eastern Kentucky. And in many situations, a tiny house could be a good, affordable option.
Tourism, student housing, just folks who want to move around, renters that would love to have a house that they owned. We need more traditional housing also, but what really excites me is the skills the students are learning are really translatable to the rest of the solutions we need.
Right now, eight schools in eastern Kentucky are building tiny houses. Students have a deadline to finish construction by April when the tiny homes will be exhibited and put up for auction to fund another round of tiny house building at each school. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Benny Becker in Whitesburg, Kentucky.
The Ohio Valley Resource is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Still ahead, for generations, Appalachians helped to keep the lights on by providing coal to the rest of the country and enjoyed some of the lowest energy costs in the nation. But that's changing. Now the coal industry's downturn is pushing electricity rates higher. That story up ahead. And we'll try to figure out what is behind all those mysterious mountain lion sightings across the hills and hollers of our ancient mountains. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Have your power rates gone up in the past year or so? If your energy bill hasn't increased, well, maybe you need to look a little closer. Or maybe increases just haven't hit your bill yet. Appalachia has historically had some of the lowest power rates in the country, a benefit of the region's legendary coal fields. But as WMMT's Benny Becker reports, the coal industry's downturn is contributing to rising power rates in more ways than one.
Angry customers and public officials filled a high school auditorium in Hazard, Kentucky, and took turns pleading with three members of the state's Public Service Commission.
This community for two centuries has been powering our nation. We're now struggling to keep our own lights on.
That's Angie Hatton, a state legislator representing Letcher and Pike counties. She was one of dozens who came to voice opposition to the roughly 15% rate increase requested by Kentucky Power, a branch of American Electric Power. Hatton says it's by far what she hears the most about from her constituents.
That's what they want to talk about. They can't afford to stay in business. That's not going to help us get back out of this terrible situation that we found ourselves in with the downturn in the coal industry here.
Kentucky Power serves a region that's lost a lot of people and businesses in the last few years. Kentucky Power's president and COO, Matthew Satterwhite, defended the rate increase as necessary to make sure the company remains profitable enough to attract investors.
Do they provide that return so in the future you have more investment so we can keep the lights on?
Satterwhite said the company has invested heavily in recruiting new businesses, and he's optimistic that the economy is turning around. But even in areas with more stable and prosperous economies, power companies are facing challenges.
Another big trend going on nationwide in general is pretty flat electricity demand.
That's Kathy Kunkel, an analyst with the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis, a research group that promotes sustainable energy. Kunkel explained that the recent recession, together with increasingly efficient homes, appliances, and light bulbs, all of that has meant that business for power companies isn't growing as steadily as it used to. And here in the Ohio Valley region, there's another challenge.
There's also a problem with our utilities having made investments in a lot of coal-fired power plants and those investments not turning out to be competitive anymore.
Coal is no longer the cheapest source of energy. It's been passed by natural gas, and renewables aren't far off. Kentucky Power, like many utilities in the region, is very much invested in coal, and that's part of why customers are paying higher prices. Kunkel says Kentucky and West Virginia laws guarantee a certain amount of profit to power companies, which lets them pass costs on to customers.
Utilities are actively looking to get ratepayers to pick up some of the costs of coal plants that the company is not finding to be as profitable as they would like.
Power companies are far from alone in betting on coal and getting burned. Throughout the coal fields, budgets have gotten tighter at every level. Back at the hearing in Hazard, Rose Wolf described the situation she sees in Jackson, Kentucky, where she serves as mayor.
Our seniors and our elderly are drawing just over $600 a month. Their electric bills are taking one-third to one-half of their income. So who is going to help them when they can't keep their power on to stay warm?
Wolf said some are forced to choose between power, food, and medicine. She told the crowd she wants Kentucky Power to share part of the burden.
Every city and county in eastern Kentucky is being asked to do more for less. I think it's time Kentucky Power does more for less.
The Kentucky Public Service Commission is in a final round of data gathering and is expected to issue a decision soon. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Benny Becker in Whitesburg, Kentucky.
Here's another sobering reality. The opioid crisis is pushing some jails in Appalachia to fill beyond capacity. West Virginia's Governor Jim Justice recently declared a state of emergency over short staffing in many jails. The move allows the West Virginia National Guard to help staff juvenile and adult lockups across the state until a more permanent staffing solution is found. In Kentucky, the overcrowding has some judges and jailers looking into creative alternatives. Becca Schimmel reports on the economic appeal of drug treatment over jail time.
5-4-8. Imagine living and working somewhere fit for a couple hundred people. Now picture that same space crammed with twice as many people. Madison County, Kentucky jailer Doug Thomas doesn't have to imagine it. He lives it.
I'm doing all that I can with what I have to work with, and which is not a lot, because we're 184-bed facility with almost 400 people.
According to the Madison County Jail Task Force, roughly 80% of the people incarcerated are there on charges that somehow relate to addiction. Judge Executive Reagan Taylor wants to try a different approach.
It didn't take long looking at our statistics that we really didn't have a jail problem, that we had a drug problem.
Taylor says he's looking into expanding the current jail, but he wants the county to also build what he calls a healing center. People whose charges stem from a substance use disorder would be diverted to the treatment facility instead of going to jail. Taylor says a new 800-bed jail would cost about $50 million, and it would still likely be full in about 10 years.
We've got to spend money one way or the other. So do we want to spend money to where we just have to continue spending money and kicking the can down the road, or do we want to spend money to where we have a solution?
The Healing Center would provide long-term rehabilitation that would help people get back on their feet. Taylor wants it to be more than a basic detox facility. The center would include peer support, life skills, and education or vocational training. Taylor says he wants people to be able to become tax-paying members of their community again.
Everybody deserves a chance. Everybody deserves a second chance.
That's Eric Hudnall from Athens, Ohio. He was prescribed opiate painkillers after a car accident. A growing addiction and a bad influence led to his arrest for breaking into a home. That landed him in front of a prosecutor who gave him that second chance. Hudnall says it's because he was honest and spoke up about his addiction that he was given a chance to turn his life around.
For one, if it wasn't for the prosecutor's office and health recovery services, I'd probably still be, addicted to opiates or even in prison.
Hudnall says he was almost homeless when he entered the treatment program. Now he has a place to live, a steady job, and a car. Like Hudnall, there are a lot of people in the criminal justice system that are incarcerated because the need to feed their addiction led them to a crime other than drug possession. In West Virginia, for example, 43% of people incarcerated in the state's jails required substance abuse treatment of some kind in 2016. According to the National Institute on Drug Abuse, 1 year of methadone or medically assisted treatment cost about $4,700. That's 1/5 of the cost to incarcerate one person in the Ohio Valley.
Because at the end of incarceration without treatment, we still have the same problem.
That's Warren Circuit Judge Steve Wilson in Kentucky, who's been working in the legal field for about 35 years. He's seen an increase in prosecutors and judges advocating for treatment programs over jail.
Truly a tremendous driving force is the fact that economically it's much better trying to treat people than it is incarcerate people.
Wilson says the criminal justice system is often the first chance someone with substance use disorder has at getting treatment. He says prosecutors and judges need to be patient. They may well see the same offender more than once, and although it can be frustrating, he says they have to try.
I've always been afraid that once we send somebody off to prison, we really have a feeling it's not our problem anymore. We're still paying for them.
For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Becca Schimmel in Bowling Green, Kentucky.
Now, for the second half of today's episode, we'll travel to rural Virginia to try to track down the truth behind mysterious mountain lion sightings. The eastern cougar, or mountain lion, is considered by most wildlife experts to have been extinct in Appalachia for a long time. But across Virginia, Kentucky, West Virginia, and Tennessee, some people swear they've seen one. So, have they? What did they really see? WMRA's Andrew Jenner and Brent Finnegan explored the stories behind mountain lion sightings in the mountains of central Appalachia. What they found made them question this expert opinion.
I was born in Rockingham County at Montezuma, lived there all my life, still live there, and have hunted and fished throughout this area all the way to the top of the mountain here in Hone Quarry. When I was here in the fall of 78, I was hunting squirrels with a friend and had sat down by a tree on a small ridge to wait for a squirrel to show up, and a squirrel didn't, but these two cats did. Obviously a cougar, there's nothing else like them when you see them. People talk about long-tailed dogs and big bobcats and stuff, but there is no way.
I'm Brent Finnegan.
And I'm Andrew Jenner. Thank you for listening to this special production of WMRA. Today, Brent and I are talking about mountain lions in Virginia.
You know, I've lived in Virginia most of my life, but I grew up in Mission Viejo, California. And at that time, it was right on the very edge of the Orange County sprawl. So behind our house were all these wild rolling hills. And it was like this dangerous no man's land full of coyotes, rattlesnakes, and mountain lions.
There's just something cool about big cats. I've also spent most of my life in Virginia, but I grew up in East Africa where there were a number of cool big cats. My favorite was a leopard, and I was actually fortunate enough to see one a few times, and I'll just never forget it. Each time burned into my memory. But never seen a mountain lion, have you?
No. In California, we just heard a lot about them, and sometimes they would wander into the neighborhood. And even though I've done a fair amount of hiking in Virginia, I've seen a few black bears, but I've never seen a mountain lion.
Yeah, me neither. But we found a guy named Larry Carpenter who has seen one. Earlier this year, he took us to Hone Quarry west of Harrisonburg to the very spot where he saw it.
It's probably very close to where I was. Well, I was up a holler. Uh-huh. If I was like sitting against that tree, the cats weren't any further than that bank over there.
We were on one side of a steep ravine, so when he says bank over there, we're pretty close.
Yeah, it's not just, I saw some tail disappearing to a cornfield.
No, they were close, and he got a great look at two of them, a mother and a cub, and he was looking through the scope of his rifle.
You read articles about sightings or possible sightings, or I saw a big animal cross the road. It jumped, you know, just a flash here and there, and you know, to see not only one, but two, and then have them standing perfectly still when I observed them and then move on, it was definitely a privilege.
This is Bill McShay. I work for the Smithsonian Institution. I'm a wildlife ecologist. I'm based in Front Royal, Virginia, at the Conservation Biology Institute there.
How many mountain lions have you seen in Virginia?
None. I wish, but I haven't seen any.
So he's just never been as lucky as Larry.
Not only haven't I seen any with my eyes, but I run a very extensive camera trapping program for the state and for the whole region, where we now have, in the last 5 years, maybe 3 million images of wildlife from all the protected areas in the region, and there's no mountain lion pictures anywhere among the 3 million.
Yeah, with 3 million images, you would think that they would at least have like a picture of a tail or a blurry cat or something.
Well, that's kind of the crazy thing. As it turns out, the official expert opinion is that mountain lions don't exist here. They don't exist anywhere close to here.
Yeah, but I went to high school in Rockingham County, and there were several kids in my school that saw mountain lions.
But are you sure they didn't just think that they saw one?
Once or twice, maybe a week, maybe that often, we get a call or a report or something that somebody is just sure they've seen a mountain lion.
That's David Kochka. He's been the local district biologist with the Virginia Department of Game and Inland Fisheries for the past 25 years.
In 2011, he and Bill from the Smithsonian published an article in Virginia Wildlife magazine laying out a pretty clear case against mountain lions being here. And I quote, The bottom line, the Department of Game and Inland Fisheries and the National Geographic Society do not believe that mountain lions exist in the Commonwealth.
Yeah, but didn't he just say that they get like two reports a week? Does he just tell everyone that they're wrong or that they're lying?
I don't tell people they're liars. I just try to analyze what they think they may have or what they have seen and try to figure out what it may have been and put it in perspective of, you know, you got a glimpse of something in a nanosecond and now you're trying to process what it is. They know they saw something, but then their mind and or their personality, whatever, wants to say, I saw a big cat.
Okay, so I get that not every unexplained wild animal is a mountain lion, but Larry didn't just get a glimpse. He got a great view through his rifle scope of what he's certain was a mountain lion. I mean, these are real animals. We're not talking about, like, Bigfoot. These animals exist in North America.
Yeah, but out west. According to the biologists, now there's mountain lions in every continental state west of the Mississippi, plus Illinois, Wisconsin, and Michigan. And there's a few panthers, which is just a different word for the same animal, stuck down in the Everglades. But that's it, not the rest of the East.
Well, there are stories about mountain lions in Virginia dating all the way back to the earliest colonial settlements.
Back then, people were afraid of them and they shot them whenever they could. And you know how the story goes. Soon there weren't as many, and then there were none. According to some sources, the last wild mountain lion in Virginia was shot in 1882 down in Washington County. And by the early 20th century, scientists had pretty much declared mountain lions extinct throughout the East.
Except for that population that's hung on in the Everglades.
Point taken.
And people like Larry have been reporting them all over the East for decades.
Which is kind of where things get interesting, because hardly any of those reports have been substantiated by experts, whatever that means. And with the few exceptions that have, there's always some sort of weird explanation.
I would not say that there aren't any here, but there sure couldn't be many.
So you're saying there's a chance.
There's a chance. So this is Chris Bolgiano, who wrote the book on mountain lions. Literally, it's called The Eastern Cougar, and she happens to live in Folks Run. She has a really interesting perspective on all this because she's a nature writer who really understands science, and she's also spent more than 20 years chasing down mountain lion reports here.
I am skeptical. I mean, I've read an awful lot of scientific papers, and I think skepticism is the bottom line. Mm-hmm. But I can be convinced. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I'm not closed-minded. I do think there are a few out there at any given time. I think there are a few cougars in the Appalachian Mountains. Whether they're native eastern cougars, whether they're feral escaped, or whether they have moved in from the western states, which is possible, I don't know.
Okay, so something to get straight here is that not all mountain lions are created equal. Some are kept in captivity, and a few of those escape or get let go out in the woods somewhere.
Right, and then when someone sees it out in the woods, you have an actual real-life sighting of a real-life mountain lion somewhere like Virginia, where the science is quite clear that you shouldn't be seeing a mountain lion here.
Yeah, there's that one that went on a walk, a very long walk a few years ago, and somehow wandered in from the west.
That was a cool story. It was a young male that scientists tracked from South Dakota as it went out looking for a mate, and they followed it through Minnesota and then Wisconsin, and it just kept going and going all the way to New England.
And I would do anything for love. I'd run right into hell and back.
Until a Hyundai went zooming down the road in Connecticut and bam.
Bam. End of journey. It's like the mountain lion version of Oregon Trail. You have died of Hyundai.
But seriously, this was a fact. There's evidence and proof. There was a wild mountain lion in Connecticut. Why couldn't there be wild mountain lions in Virginia?
Maybe it's like people on the moon. Like, way out of place and only there for a very little bit. It's just a total anomaly, and it's not the same thing at all as actually living there.
There was a kitten killed on the road in Kentucky, a cougar kitten, in 1997. A game department person came and collected it. Mm-hmm. They did DNA testing on it. The mother's genes had South American genes, which almost certainly means that there was a captive cougar in there somewhere. However, the father's genes were North American and could have been wild. So, what do we have?
That's a mystery.
Weird. So even the line between wild and escaped can get blurry.
And to be fair, Smithsonian Bill and the other scientists do acknowledge these very rare, random occurrences. But as biologists, their main concern is really with populations of mountain lions.
I'm not going to say there's never been a mountain lion in the last 10 years. There are. It's impossible for someone to see a mountain lion. Even 3 million images is not really a lot when you look at the amount of forest that we have in this region. So could there be something out there? Yes. From my point of view, what I would say is there's no hidden population of mountain lions. There's no valley full of mountain lions living a happy life. From as an ecological agent, as a part of the ecosystem, I'm pretty confident mountain lions don't play a part in the functioning of this region.
So it's easy to get hung up on all the little bits and scraps of evidence that mountain lions might be here. But there's a flip side. There's a lot of really strong evidence that they're not here. Here's David Kochka again.
We have a bow hunter survey that is conducted every year and has been for 15 years or so now in the state of Virginia, like other states. Bow hunters spend a tremendous amount of time in tree stands. We survey these people, and they keep records of, you know, various species that they see, and we track those things. Nobody has ever seen a big cat. We have thousands upon thousands of dog hunters in this state that use dogs, whether they're hunting raccoons or black bears or foxes or coyotes or whatever, and none of those people tree a mountain lion.
Man, he sounds exasperated. You get the sense that all this mountain lion stuff gets a little old for the biologists.
Yeah. It's like, how many times do I have to tell you guys? I mean, listen to what they do have to put up with.
We've had calls where people say, well, I just drove on this interstate or whatever in Virginia, and I just saw one, and it's dead at mile mark or whatever. And, you know, and in those situations where we've had somebody near enough that they can go look at it, you know, it has turned out to be, you know, a dog, and not even a tan dog. It might be a totally different colored type of dog. One instance, it was a gray fox. We called the guy back, told him it was a gray fox. And he's like, well, I don't know, but somebody must have moved the mountain lion and put a gray fox there because there was a mountain lion this morning when I passed it.
Can you imagine that? It's like, hey, I'm going to take this gray fox that I have and I'm just going to swap it out for that rotting mountain lion.
There's that whole substantiated by experts thing that can get a little touchy. Like, what makes him an expert and not somebody who's been living in the mountains their whole life?
But that's how our culture is now, right? Like, look at climate denying or vaccine refusing or whatever. It's almost like being an expert diminishes your credibility for some people.
Yeah, I don't know. I think this is different. This mountain lion thing is more personal than that. I mean, when you see something and you know what you saw, but you don't have the credentials or the degree or whatever that makes you an expert, and then you get told, well, you must have been imagining things, or straight up, like, you're a liar.
Yeah, I mean, okay, who wants to be called a liar, like, either directly or by implication? I guess maybe you or I would feel differently if we saw something and we knew what we saw.
Yeah, what is it about mountain lions, you know? There are all kinds of rare birds and salamanders and things all over the East Coast, but people aren't calling in reporting those twice a week. It seems like mountain lions have this special allure.
The cougar is a big, strong, threatening animal that can kill you and very rarely does kill people. The idea that there could be this animal out there that might be following you and you'd never know it, you'd never see it, you'd never suspect it was there, you know, that just gets people.
Ooh, keep your head on a swivel, folks. So that was Chris again. And of course, the biologists like Smithsonian Bill, who are on the front lines of this debate, also know how worked up people get about mountain lions.
I'm a professional wildlife ecologist, and I publish professional papers for 30 years now. And I have 150 publications probably out there on all sorts of wildlife issues. Nothing has generated nearly as much response as that one article on there being no mountain lions in the state of Virginia. For once, I realized that people are actually reading what I'm writing, because everybody wrote back. I got so many calls and letters saying, you're crazy. I've seen them. I have pictures of one. My dog was attacked by one.
People want to think that they've seen a cougar, partly because I think it makes them special. It's something that's so rare and so elusive that for them to have seen it kind of elevates them. It's like, boy, they chose me, you know? I have talked to some people that were sure they saw a cougar, and they've called it the supreme emotional moment in their lives to see a cougar.
Most people would rank it in one of the top five experiences of, you know, they tell you about their wedding, they tell you about the birth of their kids, and they tell you about their mountain lion sighting. And I don't know what to do with that. I can say, geez, I wish you'd had a camera, or I wish that animal had stayed around for a while, or left a track, or some feces, or most of these sightings, we cannot do anything more than say, wow.
Come on, cougars, just a little feces. Just give us a sign.
Yeah, it's like, are you there, cougar? It's me, Andrew. All right, seriously now, seriously. This is weird. It's like there's a million stories of people seeing them, and some are pretty believable.
Like Larry's. That guy spent his whole life outside, and he's not going to mistake a bobcat for a mountain lion. And there's no doubt in his mind that he saw one. And then there are these random 100% confirmed cases, like the cub that was killed on the road in Kentucky, or the one that had the run-in with the Hyundai.
But then there's just so much really strong evidence that the biologists have to say that they're just not here. Or when they are, it's such an incredibly rare and unusual thing that it can just be explained away, and we might as well just say they're not here. It sort of starts to mess with the definition of exist, doesn't it? It's like, I think of that as a black or white thing. Like, does God exist? Yes or no? Or does the Loch Ness Monster exist? Yes or no? Or will you go out with me? Yes or no?
No. But this, I don't know, this is different. We've established that mountain lions definitely do exist.
But not right here in Virginia, though.
Well, most likely not native cougars anyway. But like Chris was saying, there might be some escapees or strays from the West.
I'm just hung up on the fact that the story essentially seems to be there are certainly no mountain lions here, except for when there certainly are. This is just muddled.
What if there's a way that they're both right?
What do you mean, though? That's a thing. If something is or isn't.
Have you ever heard of Schrödinger's cat?
Nope.
It's this thought experiment where there's this house cat in a box with a bunch of stuff that might kill it, and you can't see inside the box, and like after an hour, it's alive. It's alive and dead or something.
What does it have in there? Guns? Cigarettes?
No, I think it's some vial of poison or something.
Well, what does that have to do with mountain lions, though?
I don't know. I'm probably not explaining it right. Let me get out my phone.
Good old Wikipedia on the smartphone.
Okay. All right. Here we go. The scenario presents a cat which may be simultaneously both alive and dead, a state known as a quantum superposition, as a result of being linked to a random subatomic event that may or may not occur.
Zombie cat.
No, that would be undead. What I'm saying is the cat would be dead and alive at the same time.
I don't know.
Mountain lions could exist in Virginia and not exist in Virginia at the same time.
Alive and dead at the same time?
All of these states, both the cat being alive and the cat being dead, are superimposed on each other.
Christian Early was my philosophy professor at Eastern Mennonite University, and he's the kind of guy that I remember just really bending my mind.
We have to count with multiple
states of affairs, multiple possible realities, and we can't rule any of them out, strictly speaking, and so we have to superimpose them onto each other. And you just can't escape the possibility that the world, in all of its superimposed realities, may be much, much wilder than we can deal with. It's a little bit like a Far Side comic when people are driving in a car and they're watching a field of cows. And when no one's watching the field of cows, they're talking to each other. But when the humans are driving by, they're just saying moo. But then when they're past, they go back to talking about what happened last week or why Bob owes Jerry $2 or whatever it is. And it's just ineliminable. You cannot rule out the possibility that the world that we see is much tamer than the world that there really is. And that's the bothersome thing about Schrödinger's cat. He wanted to show that multiple realities were really absurd, but what he managed to do instead was to insert in everyone this uneasiness that possibly the world is actually much more strange than we know.
The guy from the Smithsonian told me, you know, he laughs about there's no happy valley of mountain lions. You're saying what Schrödinger's cat could suggest or tell us about this observation is that his happy valley that doesn't exist maybe does exist, but when he goes to observe it, it's not there.
There's always the possibility that when you go to the Happy Valley and you try to see these, that they disappear from view. And so you make the mistake of saying categorically it doesn't exist, but when you turn around, it pops back into existence. You just can't eliminate the theoretical possibility that the world is way stranger than your theories allow.
Okay, that got weird.
Yeah, you weren't kidding when you said he bends people's minds.
Well, where do you think all this leaves us?
I wonder what would happen if Bill or David ever saw a mountain lion. What if the scientist became a believer, like Dana Scully from The X-Files?
Or like Saul on the road to Damascus.
Yeah.
Well, we asked them about that at the end of our interviews.
I'd probably call myself crazy. No, I, you know, the professional in me would say, okay, stop, get out. If it's raining, whatever, if the soil is soft, look for tracks, you know, see what it was that crossed the road that I got a very short glimpse of, you know, and try to start from that angle.
And Bill has promised to rewrite that infamous Virginia Wildlife article if a mountain lion ever wanders around the corner into his life.
Yes, I'll write one. I'll say, I eat my hat. I mean, it's let's hope it happens.
You know, as it turns out, there is a biologist who became a believer.
Yeah. Remember Larry from the beginning of our story?
I majored in biology at Bridgewater College, and I graduated there in 71, and then went to work for the Virginia Department of Environmental Quality and got my 30 years in there, working outside with water in the environment, doing environmental spill cleanup work. And then, so I'm familiar with the outdoors. My father was the regional game biologist for this area for his career with the Game Commission. So I had a lot of experience with seeing animals. And then, of course, we hunted whenever it was possible as youth. And I've got two brothers. We all went out and followed Dad around and learned about the birds and wildlife. And so there's no doubt in my mind what I saw. I was definitely surprised because my understanding was that the eastern cougar was extinct and that any animals that were reported here, and there were reports even back then, was either an introduced animal from the West or a southern cat like from Florida that had moved in or was transported in and released. And when I saw these, you know, I was totally surprised. And they say the only way to tell the difference between an introduced cat and one from an eastern cougar is to measure skulls.
You know, I keep thinking back to that image of Larry watching the mountain lions through the scope of his rifle.
Yeah, and I realize that this is going to sound awful, but there's a part of me that kind of wishes that he had shot one of them, just so there could be proof.
You know, it's funny, if he'd done that, he could have proven that they existed, but then in a way they wouldn't have existed anymore, right?
Instead, he just watched them wander off to who knows where.
You know, there's always the thought of, well, you know, shoot one and have a definite specimen, but in 71, the Game Commission passed a law that said it was illegal to hunt them, shoot them, chase them, trap them in any manner. So I knew it was illegal. I wasn't going to break the law. But it would have been...
Were you tempted?
Oh, yes. Just to have that specimen, to have that proof that there were cats in the eastern United States.
Thanks to Andrew Jenner and Brent Finnegan for that story about one of America's ongoing mysteries, the elusive mountain lions that scientists say don't exist in our mountains, despite so many sightings. What about you? Do you have a mountain lion story you'd like to tell us about? Send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org or send us a tweet on Twitter. Our handle is @inappalachia. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from WMRA in Harrisonburg, Virginia, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WKYU in Bowling Green, Kentucky, and the Ohio Valley Resource. Music in today's show was provided by Mike Hudson, Dinosaur Burks, Andy Agnew Jr., and Ben Townsend. Roxy Todd and I produced Inside Appalachia. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. You can find us online at Twitter @InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to InsideAppalachia@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. If you'd like to listen to any part of this episode again, don't forget you can subscribe or download all of our stories on iTunes, Downcast, wvpublic.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.